The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on America's Web Radio are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the station.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to America's Web Radio. It's time now for the Doctor's Lounge Show with Dr. Scott Barber.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Doctor's Lounge. I'm Dr. Scott Barber, and you're listening to me on America's Web Radio. Today, we're going to continue our discussion of how to truly reform healthcare. I started talking about it last week, and as I reflected on my presentation, I realized that I got a little off track, and I wasn't really able to connect all the dots in the way that I wanted to. So I'm going to take another stab at it today to see if I can show you guys just how important it is to promote free market healthcare, particularly at this time in American history. We see all kinds of problems going on in the country, particularly with our continuing loss of free speech. It's really troubling to see how different people and organizations are trying to stifle free speech by using this phrase, the spreading of misinformation or the spreading of hate speech. And at the end of the day, all of this is just clearly designed to stifle free speech and to prevent open debate, because a lot of the ideas that are being presented in America today are just not palatable to people, and they simply don't stand up under scrutiny. And rather than try and debate these issues, it seems a better tactic by the people in power to want to stifle free speech, and particularly in healthcare. It's just not how I'm wired. I mean, the study of science, study of medicine is the purest form of scientific endeavor. I love the idea that they refer to medicine as the art of medicine. Open debate, constant discussion, constant testing and thinking, constant reevaluation of how things are done. I was just having a conversation with a bunch of my medical students and my PA students about how sometimes when I go through my day, I feel like my hands have been touched by God and everything goes well. And then other days, I feel like I should voluntarily relinquish my medical license because things don't go my way. And I was told a long time ago by a mentor, Dr. Lonegro, that you need to always be reading. You need to always be contemplating, reflecting, evaluating, and seeing if there are better ways to do things. I've talked about it on this show before that the Hippocratic Oath is do no harm. When I first heard that oath, I thought that seems like a silly oath for a doctor. But now having been practicing medicine now for 30 plus years, it is the best possible oath, because whenever we do anything in healthcare, we always want to do it from the standpoint of first do no harm. Whatever we do, we don't want to hurt anybody. We don't want to cause problems. We don't want to make it worse. We want to make things better. And what we've seen over the decades is a progressive control of our healthcare system by a government, one size fits all, top down controlled system where you have a few oligarchs at the top trying to make decisions for every single person down below us. And these people have no idea about what our wants, needs, and desires are as individuals regarding our healthcare. They don't know who we are, and they don't care, because at the end of the day, this government control of healthcare is really about money and power. Now, this idea of the thing that got me triggered and got me really focused on this particular issue was, I can't remember what I was listening to, somebody's podcast. And they were talking about the upcoming presidential election and the idea that Trump needs to come up with a healthcare plan. Now, coming up with a healthcare plan has been something that I've been privy to for many, many years. I've been involved politically, trying to promote free market healthcare. And it's so frustrating to come up with this idea of a healthcare plan. The idea that you could control an economy. I mean, healthcare is 20% of the American economy, and the idea that a few people can come up with a plan on how to deliver that healthcare to, the 350 million Americans, and others, is ridiculous. And it reminds me of, the economist Friedrich Hayek's book, The Road to Serfdom, and how he talked about this, you know, infinite sea of ships, and that if you had some single person in control of all these ships, how there'd be no way to really control their movements and prevent them from colliding into one another. But if you allow each one of those ships to act individually, they can control their own direction and you get an orderly procession of these ships. And I thought, man, that's just such a genius way to think about something as complex as healthcare. There are infinite numbers of wants, needs, desires, and perspectives that no individual or group of individuals could possibly manage, and that this needs to be individually controlled. And that's the beauty of the American experiment, is individual rights and the focus on the individual, which at the end of the day leads to a better society for all. And, you know, it's under attack right now. I mean, we see we've got a federal government coming in. Joe Biden is again trying to steal votes by saying that he is going to forgive student loans. And we talk about it on this show all the time. There's no forgiving loans. There's no forgiving debt. He's not paying for it. There's the only thing that changes with debt is who pays. You know, Dan Bongino, who is really great on this, talks about it all the time, that, you know, no debts are forgiven. Either the debtor pays, or if the debtor doesn't pay, then the creditor pays. But somebody always pays. And the idea that these student loans are going to be forgiven is ridiculous. It's simply the tab is going to be picked up by the American taxpayer. And that's a very unfair situation, as you have people that are receiving college degrees getting funded by lots of people who didn't get college degrees. And it's simply ridiculous. The other part of it is the government has managed to take total control of the healthcare system through Medicare, Medicaid, SCHIP, and things like that. They ostensibly control the rules and regulations of healthcare, and it makes it nearly impossible for individual free market entities to be successful, and it's getting worse and worse. Now, they dress things up in a way to make you feel like you have independent free market healthcare. You know, you can go and get Blue Cross Blue Shield, or you can go and get United or Aetna or Humana, the few healthcare systems that are out there are insurance policies. But the reality is, with the passage of Obamacare, each one of those insurance programs is required by the law, the Obamacare law, that they provide certain things. The government controls the price that can be charged, and actually takes into consideration the amount of money that can be lost by these institutions. And so a lot of the burden of this healthcare system is being dumped onto the American taxpayer, and we end up with a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse. And then on top of that, we also see a limiting of our healthcare options. Now, I've been really frustrated with this. So a long time ago, when I first got out of medical school, got out of my residency and started training, I started a practice with three friends from my residency program. And we started our first practice with no understanding of the mechanics of the business side of healthcare. We didn't understand how these insurance companies worked. We didn't understand the monumental control of the healthcare system via the hospitals, the monumental control that Medicare and Medicaid regulations put on the overall practice of medicine, because these regulations ostensibly control the function of the hospital systems, and that's where most of the healthcare is delivered. And so, because we didn't understand this stuff, our first practice went out of business. Now, during that time, obviously, I learned a lot the hard way about the business of medicine and just how controlling the government is, how much their fingerprints are on the practice of medicine, and making it very difficult for private physicians to practice. And these Medicare regulations come down. They have this constant decrease in reimbursement to physicians over the years. And this decreased reimbursement eventually drove private doctors out of business. And the reason was the Medicare reimbursement is lower than the cost to provide medicine. So if you're running a business, you have to pay employees, you have to pay your electric bill, you have to pay your rent, you have to pay for all of your medical equipment and your medical goods. And of course, you have to pay your staff. And that, when you pay all of these things at market prices, Medicare reimbursement to physicians doesn't cover those costs. Now, the hospital systems and the government controlled systems, they can get away with it because no matter how much money they lose, they're always sponsored by the American taxpayer. And so these systems lose money year after year, year after year, but stay in business. But the private doctors eventually went out of business. They could no longer maintain their private practices and eventually had to make a decision to close. And then in order to continue the practice of medicine, they would need to get employed by a hospital system. And then you have an employed physician. And there are a lot of ramifications of an employed physician versus a free market physician that we're going to get into in a little bit. But this plan was by design, because when you look at the political control of money and the power that comes along with the control of healthcare, something that is in the way of that is the individual behavior of individual doctors and patients. And we saw that very clearly in COVID. And it's not just in COVID. It's in everything healthcare. The idea is that these healthcare systems, these hospital systems, which we have, you know, major hospital systems in large cities, and there's a lot of political power and a lot of money that changes hands there. And these hospital systems are no different than these teachers unions. So when you look at a teachers union, negotiating with politicians, you have the teachers union and you have the politicians sitting at the negotiating table, and the teachers union say, we need more money and better regulations for us. And the politicians say, well, we would love to provide that for you. So they agree to give more money to the teachers unions. And where do the politicians get that money? Well, they get it from the taxpayer. So the politicians give the money to the teachers union, and then the teachers union then gives that money in the form of political donations back to the politicians. And the American taxpayer sitting on the sidelines saying, hey, the education that you are delivering to my kids is horrific. You know, our kids are not learning math. They're not learning to read. They're being indoctrinated into a progressively Marxist ideology and view of the world. We're developing or creating all of these America-hating youth. American taxpayers don't want that. But we don't have any control because they don't have a seat at the table. Well, the healthcare system is very similar to that. You have these large hospital systems that are basically funded by government taxpayer dollars through the entities of Medicare, Medicaid, SCHIP. And what happens is the hospital systems are constantly lobbying the politicians for regulations, greater reimbursement to the hospital systems with these Medicare and Medicare funds. Now, the money that goes to the actual hospital systems into what they do is good money. The money that goes to the providers, that's not good money. So, that's another layer of complication, is that people don't understand. There's always what we call the facility fee, and then there's always what you call the provider fee. So there's money that goes to pay the provider, which is usually low, and then the money that goes to pay the facility for their procedures is usually pretty good. And, you know, that would be something like if you get an MRI, the Medicare may reimburse $3,500 for that MRI, and that is extremely high. But what you're seeing here is you see the politicians allocating money to these hospital systems, and these hospital systems are very powerful. They have lots of employees, and they have the ability to control elections, and we've seen it time and time again. If you were to ever get a politician in there that was trying to stifle the flow of money to these hospital systems, they would end up getting voted out of office because these hospital systems wield so much political power. And so what you have are politicians that understand that if they don't continue to keep funding these hospital systems, they're going to be eventually voted out of office. And what we see here as when I first came out of training, a majority of doctors were private entities. They were in private practices. And the beauty of that, the benefit of that, is the fidelity of the doctor was directly to the patient, or I should say customer, as it should be. But as doctors began to be driven out of business and began to be employed by hospital systems, their fidelity then becomes to their employer and not to their patient. And this, of course, was by design. And we saw this during COVID. And it's not just COVID, but COVID really put a fine point on this and really made it easy to see. And many of us know that if you went to the hospital and you had been doing some reading, as I was doing, and you thought to yourself, hey, I would like to get some early treatment. I just am starting to feel a little ill. And maybe I would like some hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, which, by the way, after we've gone through this whole nightmare, the CDC, our agencies, have now agreed that both hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin are appropriate treatments for COVID. But at the time, when we were in the COVID pandemic, the hospital systems were saying no. They were allowing you to be treated with remdesivir, which had negative side effects and didn't work, but you weren't allowed to prescribe ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, and employed physicians were basically told you can't provide early treatment. And so we saw in very clear terms how a hospital-employed physician behaved differently than a private physician would, and not necessarily in the best interest of their patients. And that really crystallized it for me. Now, just to kind of get back to the early days when I was trying to affect political change and to try and promote free market healthcare, you would find some allies out there. You know, there's think tanks out there like the Heritage Foundation. There are politicians, you know, a lot of Congress people are physicians, and they kind of are sympathetic to the cause. Not as much, because they're really, once they go to Congress, they're really no longer doctors anymore. And you see lobbyists and other non-governmental organizations that say they want to promote free market healthcare. And so what happens is doctors like me take out of our time to go and collaborate with these entities in an effort to affect legislative change. And sadly, what I found over time is that each one of these entities is really only concerned with themselves. They want to promote their notoriety. They want to generate revenue for their own entities. And I know that there are some very famous politicians out there. I'm not going to use their names, but I know you guys know who they are if I were to say them, that these politicians, or I should say these political actors, that many of them are in their own non-governmental organizations now, they will say to you that they are in the fight for freedom, but then when you go and talk to them, they need, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to participate. And I remember thinking to myself, like, man, I'm up here as a citizen just trying to affect political change because it's the right thing to do for my fellow citizens in the United States. And you would think these people would do it too. But in the reality, you see that this political machine, the culture of DC, is really just its own little ecosystem, and everybody is in it to support their own political power, their own their own influence, and to basically make money off it. And so what would happen is doctors would go up and support. They would usually ask for money and donations, but you'd never see those doctors on TV, or you would very rarely see those doctors on TV. They would always put their people on TV or put their people in the spotlight. And I remember thinking to myself, why is this person giving the speech to the crowd, or, you know, why is this person the one that's going on TV to discuss things when they don't really have any personal knowledge of what was going on? And it just got to be very frustrating. You'd have these, situations come, and, you know, I remember the passage of Obamacare when it finally happened, and I can't remember the situation, but it came down, to one vote. And it just barely passed. We know there were all kinds of shenanigans that went on in the government with, the bill originating in the Senate and not in the House. There was just a ton of stuff that was wrong with Obamacare, but you could see that the machine simply wanted it passed, and they were not going to allow it to fail. And then once Obamacare got instituted, you saw the steady, dramatic, consistent, and ongoing decline of the healthcare system and quality, freedom, and all the rest. The cost of healthcare has gone through the roof. And one of the other frustrating things about healthcare is for most young, healthy people or just healthy people in general, they don't access the system. And so when you don't access the system, you're not really familiar with the flaws in the system. And that's one of the things that makes the government takeover of healthcare easier for these people, is that we don't have, as regular citizens, we don't have a common experience where we're dealing with it all the time. We kind of have our insurance card in our wallet and we feel like, okay, I'm covered if anything happens. But we don't typically access the system, so we don't see the problems. Like, okay, I'm paying all this money in premiums, and now I get an injury, and I let's say I need a surgery, and they say, okay, your deductible is $10,000. It's like, well, wait a second, I've been paying you all this money, and you know, now I need the surgery. Like, $10,000 is the cost of the entire surgery. You're basically making me pay cash for the surgery. And the answer is, yeah, that was the plan all along. And the way they do this is, if you're somebody with means, you're Obamacare, and I say Obamacare because whether you have Blue Cross Blue Shield or United or Humana or whatever, you have an Obamacare plan. They camouflage it to make you think that you have a private health insurance, but you really have the government Obamacare plan. And if you are somebody of means, your premiums are really high. And the reason your premiums are really high is that it's necessary for them to get the money from the people who can afford it so that they can cover the premiums for the people who can't afford it. And if you're poor, your premiums are picked up by other taxpayers, but you are denied access to the system, because when it comes down to have any sort of procedure, or if you need to access the system, the deductibles and copays are so exorbitant that it's impossible for poor people to cover that. And so the government wins again by not having to dish out any of the health care. We've talked about the problems with health care. I always like to talk about the VA. You know, when there, I want to say there's something like 131 medical schools across the country, and there's I think with every medical school there's also a Veterans Administration hospital that is near the hospital, and there's a lot of training that goes on. So when you're in medical school, and of course when I was in residency, we did a lot of work at the VA, and the VA is the ultimate government bureaucracy, and you've never seen anything more horrific and more of a fail, an epic fail, and more of a dangerous delivery of healthcare. In fact, it's such a horrible situation. I really can't believe that more doctors haven't just blown the whistle on this. Or somebody just blow the whistle on how horrible it is. We touch on it every now and then. You know, they'll talk about some paper that came out that showed the number of deaths that happened because of incompetence at the VA and stuff like that. And I'm always thinking to myself, man, that's such an underrepresentation of the reality of what's going on there. And just to kind of remind you guys of what a VA is like, you know, I remember when I was in medical school, we used to love to go to the VA because we were able, you know, we're all excited to become doctors. We've been in the classroom, like, busting our tails for years at this point, and now we're starting to get into the hospitals and dealing with patients, and you're able to take your craft and start putting it into practice. And there was very little supervision at a VA hospital. You know, medical students were pretty much free to do what they needed to do. And, you know, there was an honest effort to take care of patients for the most part. But, you know, when you're inexperienced and you don't have any practical knowledge, obviously the level of care is very poor. And just to give you an example, when I was in medical school, we had one of my classmates, he was not very good. And this is the other thing I want to talk to you guys about too, is how the white coats are not the same. You know, I think a lot of people kind of have the idea that, like, if you go see a doctor and they're wearing a white coat, that they're the same as every other doctor. But I'm here to tell you, the doctors are no different than any other cross-section of America, and maybe even a little worse. I would say a lot of them are soft, you know, emotionally. The point I'm trying to make is, when you look at doctors, there are some amazing ones out there, but there are also some that are very poor, not very capable, not very ethical, just like any other human being. You know, there's nothing special about doctors other than they typically are pretty good at standardized tests, because that's kind of the one thing that they really focus on, is standardized test taking. But other than that, my observations were very, I was very disillusioned when I got to medical school. And you guys know my story. I applied to medical school 5 times. I had to take the MCAT 3 times. I learned about I had to go through discovering, I had a severe reading disability. I had to learn how to read. It was a very big deal for me to get into medical school, but God had a plan. So by the time I showed up in medical school, I was ready for this. Also, you know, my father taught me about being an honorable person, you know, and doing the right thing and responsibility to other people. And, you know, my grandfather was that way as well, always talking about, hey, listen, you have to consider other people at all times. And, you know, my mother was a nurse, and she taught me that true fulfillment in this life is in service to others. I took becoming a doctor very seriously. I remember studying and thinking to myself, I have got to know this. I'm tired. I don't want to study anymore, but I have to do it. I owe this to my future patients to be the best possible doctor that I could be. But not everybody was like that. My roommate at the time, Julian, he was out partying all the time. And I can remember he would come into my room like the night before a test, and he would ask me some basic question. I remember thinking to myself, like, man, if you're asking me that question right now and the test is tomorrow, you have no shot on this test. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, it was just a different way of looking at things. But anyway, just to get on with this other medical student we had. So we had this guy. One of the things they do in medical school is when you show up, they try to take advantage of you. You know, you're very excited about being a doctor. You're in the club. And so they have these salespeople come in that are selling you stethoscopes and the little leather doctor bags, you know. I don't know if you young people might not know, but back in the old days when doctors used to do house calls, they used to have these leather bags that they thought that they, I always thought they looked like a bowling ball bag, you know, little leather bags. You keep your stethoscope and your, you know, all your different things in there, and you could go do house calls. And so, you know, you're all excited and you want to be a doctor, and you show up and they're selling you all this stuff. And so all these young medical students, I was 5 years older than most of my classmates. They're all excited. They're buying the bowling bag. They're buying these super expensive stethoscopes. And I, of course, was smart enough to know I don't want to go into debt. I'm planning on being an orthopedic surgeon, so I probably don't even need a stethoscope. So I went to like CVS or something like that, and I bought a $10 nursing stethoscope that had an orange, you know, the plastic part of it was all orange. And it was so funny to me because people would buy these stethoscopes called the Littmann II. They were like $300 stethoscopes. This is back in the early 90s. So, you know, like $1 jillion today, and they're buying these stethoscopes. I bought mine for $10. And when we would get on the floors, all the students with the Littmann IIs would be asking to use my stethoscope because my $10 stethoscope works so much better than theirs, and you could hear everything, which is funny how the world works, right? So anyway, I'm back at the VA. We go on rotation, and we have multiple medical students. So usually have a team. I don't know. Maybe we had 5 or 8 students, and each one of us had a resident. So 8 students, 1 resident, maybe another assistant resident assigned to a doctor. So our doctor was Dr. Lonegro. He was this really scary guy, been around for a long time. He was, you know, had a very stern face. Anybody who's old enough to remember the movie The Paper Chase remembers John Houseman played the very scary lawyer teacher for the guy in law school. That's how I thought of this Dr. Lonegro guy. He's just really scary, really intense. And when he would pimp you on things, you know, it was very intimidating. So we had this medical student who was very bad, and he couldn't really present. In the morning when we would have our patients, we would have to present the patient in a formal way, the way we were trained in medical school to present the information. And Dr. Lonegro was kind of scary to present to because he would humiliate you and ask you questions and try and, you know, make you feel small. And if you didn't know your stuff, you were going to get humiliated. And this guy just, he wasn't very knowledgeable. He just was kind of a weak-minded person. He didn't study well. He didn't know the information, and he really didn't have any confidence, and he couldn't present it. And it was actually very painful to watch him present to Dr. Lonegro. So one night The resident and I stayed up with him. So this is going on. We're seeing patients all through the night. So that's also rough, is you're exhausted because you're up all day, up all night, and then you got to go to work the next day. At least you used to have to do that back in the old days. So anyway, we're staying up with him and we're trying to teach him how to present. And so we're going over it with him. We're like giving him advice. We're practicing and all this. And it seems like he's got it. And you know, I'm telling him like, man, just be confident. Look at him in the eye and everything. So anyway, morning comes, it's time to present. He comes, you know, we go around the table and it's his turn and he starts presenting to Dr. Lonegro and he's actually doing a pretty good job. He's organized. He sent now that he wasn't making eye contact. He had it all written down on a piece of paper and was just kind of reading it, which is, you know, not really how you're supposed to do it. But actually for this guy, he was doing great. So Dr. Lonegro is sitting there and he's reading. And the resident and I that helped him, we were looking at each other and kind of making facial expressions like, hey man, he's doing pretty good. I think we're going to get through this. And then all of a sudden he goes, and the patient's penis was measured to 1 centimeter. So this guy was really, the patient was very overweight and he had a lot of body edema. And so, you know, his penis was not very long because of all this swelling and everything. But it was that, for those of you who aren't medical people, that's not really a thing. You know what I mean? That's not really like a medical physical attribute, or it's not part of the exam. It's not something we mention. It's just, it makes no sense. And so he says it. And as soon as he says it, the resident and I look at each other and we make this face like, oh no, he didn't just do that. Now the guy who's doing the presentation, he's reading his paper. So he can't see Dr. Lonegro's face of astonishment that like, I can't believe you just said that. And so he continues to read. And then Dr. Lonegro says, excuse me, stop for a minute. And he goes, why in the world did you measure his penis? And the guy looked at him and he said, well, it was so small, I thought it was an anatomical abnormality. And Dr. Lonegro looked back at him and said something to the effect of like, that's why we have textbooks, so people don't do stupid things like that. And then he started crying. He started crying at the table, and then Dr. Lonegro started looking around like, is he crying? You know, it kind of reminded me of that Tom Hanks, there's no crying in baseball. Now, I say this because I just want to tell you, like, not all the white coats are the same. You know what I mean? And because all the white coats aren't the same, it is very important that patients have the ability to choose their doctors. And that is becoming more and more difficult as government takes more and more control of healthcare, and it's only going to get worse. And we're going to explore this more. I got more stories about this guy when we come back. You're listening to The Doctor's Lounge. I'm Dr. Scott Barber, and this is America's Web Radio. We'll be right back.
This is Dr. Hal Schurz from the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I want to thank you for your support. Our show is brought to you by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation, which is the only physician-led healthcare think tank in the country. Our website is www.pcfoundation.org. We need you to support our organization so that we can continue to bring you this show and the information that you need so that you can support the healthcare of you and your family.
If you want the truth about politics, medicine, weapons, classic cars, and more, you'll want to tune in to America's Web Radio. You can listen to all of your favorite shows live at www.americaswebradio.com or on demand on iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. That's www.americaswebradio.com.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to the Doctor's Lounge. I'm Dr. Scott Barber, and you're listening to me on America's Web Radio, and we are talking about the importance of free market healthcare and the idea that any politician is going to come up with a healthcare plan that's going to solve our healthcare problems is utterly ridiculous. And I'm here to make the case and help you guys see that, and so that you can vote accordingly, because the only way we are ever going to get back to free market healthcare, patient-centered healthcare, freedom of healthcare, is by allowing doctors the freedom to practice and to promote individual rights and to prevent all these government regulations from strangling the supply of healthcare and keeping up costs also and putting over a lot of power on us, right? We saw it during COVID that when the government wanted to control our behavior, They did it through healthcare by mandating vaccines and mask mandates. And, you know, if you don't do this way, you can't function in society. You can't go to school. You can't play on a sports team. You can't travel. And it was horrible. Okay. So there's a lot of power that is involved in the healthcare system to control our lives. And if we don't have doctors that are patient centric, that are, have fidelity to us as patients, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. Now, one of the things I'm trying to show you is that the system of government-run healthcare doesn't work and that the doctors are not necessarily all amazing. And just, I got to finish this one story on this medical student that I knew when I was in school. This presentation of Dr. Lonegro was just one of many presentations that he did. He was just really not a good medical student. He seemed like a nice enough guy and everything, but he just really wasn't a very good doctor. He just didn't know the information. He didn't seem to be able to learn it. He didn't have very good critical thinking skills. And I'm going to share with you another story that is both pathetic and hilarious at the same time. But so when we were in medical school, I want to say there was 154 of us in our class, maybe 152, something like that. And so, this was in the second year of medical school. So you're really mostly in the classroom the first 2 years. The first year is 100% in the classroom. Second year is like 99% in the classroom, but they let you go on the floors a little bit. So it was kind of an exciting time. And particularly going to the VA was great because we had a lot of knowledge and very little experience and being able to basically experiment. Something we look forward to, even though it might not have been, was definitely not the best thing for the patients. But this is the way that the government decides to provide free healthcare to veterans, is by giving them the worst, quality doctors. And that's something, my father buried with full military honors in Arlington Cemetery. I have a real problem with subjecting our veterans to the worst possible healthcare, but that's a topic for another day. So anyway, so when we were on the floors, we had maybe eight of us. We had one resident and our doctor was Dr. Lonegro. And so we would go and do all the labor. So we would go out on the floors and we would, evaluate the patients and we would gather the information in their lab. So people are in the hospital and we have to monitor how they're doing. So usually in the morning there's labs, a CBC, a Chem 7 or whatever. So we can monitor their biological health and we can look at their vital signs, their respiratory rate, their pulse. And we do a physical exam, stethoscope and all this kind of stuff. Now, when you're in medical school or when you're a doctor, when you have a patient that's in the hospital, the very first exam is incredibly thorough, right? So somebody gets admitted to the hospital. It's the first one. It's a very long, in-depth, full exam. You do a full exam, eyes, cranial nerves, neck, mouth, heart, lungs, abdomen, extremities, rectal exam. I mean, it's a complete full exam. Now, once you do the first exam, we call that the history and physical. That puts all the patient's medical information in what we call the history and physical. Now, on every subsequent day that you follow up on patients, you're supposed to do an abbreviated physical exam, which is kind of like, heart, lungs, abdomen, and then sort of a neurovascular check, way less in depth than the initial one, unless something changes. If there's something happens, you do a more in-depth exam, but you have to have a reason for it. So in this particular case, we were doing rounds and, we go to each patient as a group. So let's say I had four patients or five patients and I would go see them. I would do the notes. I would kind of do the basic things that I needed to do, check their wound, change the dressing, whatever, things like that. Then we meet as a group and Dr. Lonegro starts to ask the presentation. And that's when, this student, had measured his patient's penis at 1 centimeter, which was both pathetic and hysterical at the same time. And, if you're not a doctor, that's just such a out of left field thing. Like why he would have done that is just beyond me. Now we're rounding. So we go to the different patients as a group. So you go to a patient, it's not your patient. The medical student gets to the bedside. They present. Dr. Lonegro makes comments about, I want to do this, I want to do that. And he's kind of making the decisions. And then we go and we implement those decisions. Once we figure that out, then we move on to the next patient. And this is called rounding. And you do it every day. And so we're rounding on patients, and as we get into a new room, I think we're going into the ICU, which is the intensive care unit. We start to roll up on this bed, and the patient sees the eight of us plus Dr. Lonergan, our resident, coming at him, and he says, "Keep that guy away from me. That guy Goldfinger with the bowling bag." And so he was talking about this medical student, and he was the guy with the bowling bag because he was actually walking around the hospital with that leather bag of all his equipment, which in and of itself was kind of a silly thing to do. I mean, it's just weird, you know, but he just, I guess, was fantasizing about being a doctor, and he would just carry that bag around. And it was funny because it looked like a bowling bag, and he referred to him as Goldfinger, which we were all wondering, like, why do you call him Goldfinger? Well, apparently, this medical student was coming around and doing a rectal exam on this guy every single day. And so the patient was getting sick of having a rectal exam performed on him every single day. And he called the guy Goldfinger as we were walking up. Man, this spread through the medical school like wildfire. It was like the funniest thing I ever heard. And I remember at the end of medical school, I was one of the people tasked with putting together the yearbook. And so, of course, you know, a yearbook includes all kinds of funny things that happened over the course of medical school. I mean, it's like any yearbook they would do. And that had to be one of the funniest things that ever happened. And so I remember I was putting it together and it was due soon. And listen, I roasted myself the most, right? I made sure I made fun of myself the most in there. Because I didn't want to, you know, be a hypocrite. I wasn't going to make fun of other people when, you know, I'm immune. So I made sure that I was roasted in there more than anybody else. So anyway, this guy shows up at my door at, like, I don't know, nighttime. It was 7, 8, 9 o'clock at night. It was just weird. So he shows up at my door and I'm like, "Oh, hey man, what's up?" And he, you know, I invite him in the house and he's like, "Hey, I want to talk to you about the yearbook." And I'm like, what do you mean? And he goes, "Have you put anything about Goldfinger or me measuring that guy's penis at 1 centimeter in the yearbook?" And I'm thinking to myself, yes, absolutely. That's hysterical stuff. And, of course I put that in the yearbook. And he started telling me he demands that I take it out of the yearbook, that I embarrass him in front of his family, in front of his friends, which having the ability to laugh at yourself is a very mature and normal sort of behavior. And when you take yourself so seriously that you can't laugh at yourself about these things, it says something about your character. And I'm telling you, that has influence over the way that person is going to internalize information, presented to information, and the critical decisions that they make throughout their life. This lack of a sense of humor. And of course he came over and he asked me to take it out. So of course I took all of it out. I left all the stuff in there for me. I probably added more roasts of me in there to offset this stuff. But the reason I share you these stories is I just want you to know that when I applied to medical school 5 times and wasn't getting in, and, you know, I really understood just how competitive it was, how well you had to do on the MCATs and everything. By the time I got accepted to medical school on my 5th try and I showed up to medical school, I really thought that I was going to be in an environment of the greatest people that I had ever seen in my life. The greatest group of, you know, we would be right up there with Navy SEALs. You know what I mean? It would be Navy SEALs and then medical students. And what I found was not that at all. Like, doctors are just like any other human being. There are some good, some bad, some capable, some not capable. And the important point of this is do not turn your well-being over to some person because of their education, because of their title, because of any past accomplishments. You need to maintain control of your healthcare by yourself, because there is nobody out there that has the ability to manage your wants, needs, desires, particularly your healthcare, which is one of the most important things that we have. And even worse, they aren't you. So they don't care about you in the same way that you care about yourself. Okay. Now, I think I've made the point. Good doctors, bad doctors, all the white coats aren't the same. And not only that, but when we go out and we train, you know, I'm an orthopedic surgeon. You know, that's, I do bones and muscles, tendons, all that kind of stuff. And I have a lot of experience with that, but I'm not a cardiologist. I know something about it. you know, I know a lot about it. I know more than most people about it, but I'm not necessarily the guy you want to go to for your cardiology stuff. And so sometimes you have a problem that's kind of between specialties, and it really ought to be up to you about who you want to see. Like, I see sometimes, for example, that a patient can't go see an orthopedic surgeon directly with certain health insurances. They have to go see their primary care doctor first and then get a referral to go see their orthopedic surgeon. Well, that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, because when you go see your primary care doctor, they have no idea what we do in orthopedics. So the idea that they could be a gatekeeper is ridiculous, because they don't know what I can do. They don't know what I know, and they don't know what the medical problem is with the patient. For example, if you have a labral cartilage tear in your hip, and you go in and you're like saying, I'm having this groin pain and everything, this primary care doctor most likely, because most orthopedic surgeons did, or at least a lot of orthopedic surgeons didn't know about this labral cartilage tear in the hip for many years, they're not going to know about it. And if they don't know about it, they don't have any ability to gatekeep and decide whether or not you get to go see a specialist. And so it's very important for you to understand all the white coats are not the same. Now, the next level of importance here is the understanding of basic economics, because at the end of the day, healthcare is 20% of our economy. A lot of it is very expensive, and we are here as a society trying to decide what is the best way to deliver healthcare. And what is economics? Economics is the study of how to allocate scarce resources which have alternative uses. Okay? How do we allocate scarce resources which have alternative uses? That is economics. And healthcare is certainly the type of service has the type of issues that are scarce resources, and so we have to allocate them somehow. And how do we do that? There's only two ways to allocate scarce resources which have alternative uses, and that is either a pricing system, right? A pricing system which is developed through competition and through supply and demand, or you can have government rationing. And when I say government, whatever managing body, somebody has to be rationing that stuff. Well, just as a primary care doctor cannot be a gatekeeper for a specialist, because the primary care doctor has no knowledge of what the specialist can or can't do, and therefore can't possibly evaluate a patient and decide if there's anything that can or can't be done, it's the same thing. You can't have some individual that knows how to allocate scarce resources. That has to be done by individuals working in an area that they work in commonly, and develop an expertise. If you're a mailman and you deliver to a neighborhood, you know that neighborhood better than anybody. You know where the roads are narrow. You know where they park the cars in the way, so it's tough to get through. You know the best way to go efficiently drop mail off at every house. You couldn't have some government bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. telling a mailman in Idaho how to deliver their mail. It's the person who's doing the job that knows how to do it. And healthcare is even more intricate in that way. So, you can't have a rationing system that's effective, because what happens is the people in control ration things according to their wants, needs, and desires, and according to their beliefs and their ethics. And as we have seen, that can be very different from yours. I talk about it right at the top of the muffin. I'm give a shout out to my buddy Phil out there who sent me the t-shirt top of the muffin. And I always share the story about how I was in working at the fitness club when I first got out of school, and I went over to get a muffin for me and my friend, and I cut the muffin in half, and I cut the top off and gave her the bottom, which was the bigger piece. And she looked at me and she's like, what are you doing? And I was like, what are you talking about? She's like, why did you cut it like that? I want some of the top. And I was like, I gave you the bigger piece. And I said, I like the top. And she looks at me and she goes, everybody likes the top of the muffin. And I didn't think about that. I thought I was giving her the biggest piece of the muffin. And in my mind, I was like, I want the top of the muffin. And I didn't give her any thought, or I didn't give the situation any thought, that maybe she wanted part of the top of the muffin too. And it wasn't malicious on my part. I honestly just didn't think about it. But it's such a good metaphor for why you can't have people making decisions about your medical care. They know nothing about you. They know nothing about your wants, needs, and desires. And medicine is very intricate, and there are infinite things that can be done And sometimes there's not a right answer. You know, if you go to, there are certain medical issues, you might go see 10 different specialists and get 10 different opinions about what to do. And then you have to make a decision on your own based on your own wants, needs, desires, and ethics. Okay? So I think I've clearly made the point that of the two ways to ration scarce resources that, of the two ways to allocate scarce resources efficiently that have alternative uses, that a pricing system is a much better idea. And it goes without saying. I mean, everybody knows it. Even the Marxists know it. The only reason they would try and argue that, oh, you need a government universal health care, because it's not universal health care. It's universal health control. You're not getting access to universal health care. They want it because it provides money and power to the regime. That's what the Marxists do. The other thing we need to talk about is our basic economics, because at the end of the day, we're going to have a pricing system, and we need to understand our basic economics and healthcare. We talk about Milton Friedman's four ways to spend money, and it's so important. Milton Friedman, the great economist, the four ways to spend money. You can spend your money on you. That is the best way to spend money. And the reason is because cost matters, it's your money, and quality matters, whatever you're buying, it's for you. And so the decisions that you make are focused on cost and quality. Now, the next best way to spend money is your money on others. Or, you know, a less better way to spend money is your money on others. Cost matters, but quality doesn't, right? Because you're spending your money. That's, you know, that cost matters. It's your money. But the quality doesn't matter nearly as much because you're getting it for someone else. And as much as you'd like to say, oh, no, I care, I would get, you don't. You don't consider what you're buying for other people nearly as much as you do for yourself. The next best way to spend money is spending other people's money on you. Now, in that situation, it's not very good because if it's other people's money, cost is irrelevant, right? You don't care. It's not your money. Quality does matter. It's for you. And the absolute worst way to spend money, which is how government-run healthcare and really government in general spends money, is spending other people's money on other people. That is the worst possible way of spending money because neither cost nor quality matter. The cost doesn't matter because the people who are spending it, it's not theirs. And the quality of what they're buying doesn't matter because it's not for them. And thus, that's how you end up with the VA, right? You get the Veterans Administration because you got these government bureaucrats that are spending other people's money on other people and they couldn't care less. And what happens is you put employees in a situation where cost and quality don't matter. They put limitations and rules in place in an attempt to ration. And what you end up getting is no care whatsoever. And I'm just going to give you some explanation. I already kind of talked to you about through medical school and residency how you've got these very incompletely trained doctors that have a lot of power and a lot of, you know, they're basically the ones implementing the healthcare. And, you know, somebody who's really inexperienced, maybe it's good for them and it's good for us to learn, but it's not necessarily the best thing for the patients. Now, when I was in residency on orthopedics, I want to say the third year and the fifth year would go over. Actually, no, this is when I was an intern. So when I was an intern, the first time I went over to the VA, I was there with my buddy Lex. And Lex and I were both in the same class. Lex is the smartest guy I've ever met. I mean, this is a guy, kind of guy who could read a textbook overnight and he have it memorized the next day. I remember when we, every year in medical or in residency, we would take the orthopedic in-training exam. And everybody would take the same exam, but you're only compared to your class. So first years took the exam, you were just compared to first years for your percentile ranking. And so Lex took the test when we were first years and he got in the 99th percentile for the fifth years. Like, how is this even possible? I remember the next day asking him, like, how in the world did you do so well? Like, how do you know all this orthopedics? And he told me he doesn't know these orthopedics. He just knows how to take these tests and he can look at the questions and know the answer based on the pattern of the questions. And I thought, man, this dude is ridiculous. Anyway, he and I are over at the VA and he was very similar to me. He was passionate about being a doctor. It was his life, his being. He felt a real responsibility to being the best possible doctor. And we used to talk a lot about doing the right thing for patients and, you know, going the extra mile for our patients. So when we get to the VA, what we see are a lot of government bureaucrats that were unwilling to work. And as a result, we saw very poor processing of patients, very poor treatment of patients. And Lex and I got together and we said, you know what? We're not going to let the laziness of all these other people get in the way of our caring for the patients. We're going to just take matters into our own hands. And so, for example, on operating days, we would go up, you know, normally you have different people to bring patients down to the pre-PACU, we call it, a pre-anesthesia care unit and post-anesthesia care unit, getting them ready for surgery. We then go into the operating room and then we do the procedure, and then you put the patient in recovery. And so what happened was we would go up and get the patient ourselves, because if we relied on the bureaucrats working there, they just wouldn't bring the patient down. So we'd go grab the patient ourselves. We'd put them on the bed. We'd go and we'd do the operation. If I needed any equipment, so like sometimes you need equipment and I would have to say, hey, I need equipment. And somebody would take a union break and they'd get around to getting their equipment whenever they wanted. And it could be a long time. Sometimes you'd wait an hour for like a screwdriver or something. So we would just scrub out, go down to the core, get the equipment that we needed, come back, scrub back in, finish the surgery. Then when we were done, we would be the ones taking the patient off the bed, put them on the gurney. We took them to the PACU. We would then go back into the operating room. We would grab the mop and everything. We call it turning over the room. We would turn over and clean the room really fast, because if we waited on the employees there, they would do it very, very slowly. And then we would run upstairs and we would go get the next patient and we would start the process all over again. And what we did was we tripled the output in the operating room. I mean, we really, just by doing a little work, really improved the care that these patients were getting. And that went on for about 3 weeks. And then the head of the hospital called us into the hospital. And I remember Lex and I were like, man, AJ First was his name. And, he's calling us up to go see him. And, we're in the elevator. We're kind of high-fiving each other and we're thinking he wants to get our busts. You know, they're going to do a mold for our busts, that they're going to put statues of us in the front of the clinic for being so awesome in the front of the hospital. And boy, were we wrong. We got into his office and he sat there and he lectured us like a psycho for like 8 hours about messing up his system. And what had happened was, because we were working hard, we were creating work for the other employees there, and they complained to him and he didn't want to hear it. He didn't want to hear this complaint. He didn't care that the patients were getting better treatment. He wanted us to stop causing trouble with the patient or with the employees at the hospital. And so he told us to stop doing what we were doing. Otherwise, he would make sure that we would never get the fellowships that we wanted to get, basically threatening our careers because we were working hard. That was a real punch in the face for me. And it was emblematic of what happens when you have a government system where you have a medical system that is not, that does not have direct fidelity to the patients. Now, I had a couple things more to do. I'm actually going to do part three next week, because this topic is just so important, and we're about to come into election season, where they're going to be talking about healthcare, and you have to understand, free market healthcare is the way to go. It provides the best quality healthcare at the lowest price with the most options, and it's always evolving and giving you the best innovation. And anything short of that is going to lead to worse healthcare. And not only that, it's not just about our healthcare, it's about our freedom. And we saw that with COVID, where they tried to use the healthcare system to control our behavior, and we can never let that happen again. And we got a big task ahead of us, because we got to start attracting quality doctors, quality students to go into medicine, because it's an important field and we need the best possible people to be there. It needs to be a merit-based system, just like our pilots need to be merit-based. And we're going to pick this up more next time. I want to thank you all for joining the show. I'm Dr. Scott Barber. You're listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm out.
The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on America's Web Radio are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the station.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.